This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline in the Triangle Business Journal. Fiber woes. In an effort to wire the Triangle with Uber speed, voice data, and video services, Google and others are ripping apart neighborhoods. Is this the price of technology? And that's the headline on the front page. Another headline inside where the article begins. Fiber wars. Fiber's arrival brings high hopes and hacked-up yards. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Nearly 2 years after Google Fiber's very public announcement that it would be bringing high-speed internet to Triangle metros, Google Fiber's plans for a Triangle rollout remain shrouded in secrecy, at least in theory. When asked about their plans, Google representatives deliver generic, prepared statements. Its contractors, primarily Bechtel, declined to comment, citing non-disclosure agreements. But work crews across the Triangle are leaving a trail of clues about the company's plans, clues that have damaged yards and frayed the patience of homeowners. While customers are only connecting in Morrisville, yards across the Triangle, from Raleigh to Durham, bear pockmarks caused by equipment. Commutes are delayed as right-of-way work commences. The massive Google Fiber project even has Raleigh officials meeting weekly to monitor its progress. And while a city official says the project has been mostly positive, others aren't so sure. For some Triangle neighborhoods, high expectations are being dampened by water main breaks, sewage line cuts, and a lack of communication about Google Fiber's plans. "I'm fed up," says Doug Sanders, a Raleigh homeowner whose yard hosted fiber digging equipment. He's not alone. The city of Raleigh has issued at least 18 official notices of violation to Google Fiber contractors since construction began nearly a year ago, resulting in nearly $62,000 in fines and damages for everything from sewage line disruptions to water main breaks. And that's not including community complaints some residents, such as Sanders, say have yet to be resolved. Google Fiber is not the only company whose fiber dreams are leaving scars across Triangle yards. AT&T also has seen complaints from 2 years of digging in Raleigh. Records from the city show at least 54 violations impacting city-owned utilities in Raleigh and Garner. It's a price the market and some homeowners are bearing as the new technology snakes across the Triangle. Need for speed. Experts say the Triangle's fiber story is just beginning. A year from now, North Carolina will have the most competitive fiber market in the country, says Blair Levin, former executive director of the National Broadband Plan and senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. Google Fiber and its contractors would not answer specific questions about their construction process, but Matt Gerard, a fiber design engineer at Raleigh-based enterprise fiber provider Solito, which has been digging fiber lines for 8 years, says most companies approach projects the same way. When a route is identified, companies have to get permit approvals. In Raleigh, that means city council approval. In Google Fiber's case, it received a master encroachment agreement, meaning the company doesn't have to go to the council each time it wants to build. The next step is obtaining what's called the locates, working with North Carolina or with NC811 to ensure digging won't disrupt lines already in the ground, Gerard explains. Utilities from Time Warner Cable to Duke Energy to AT&T are notified and have 72 hours to mark their lines. "That's where all the orange paint, the red, the green, that's where they come in," he says, pointing to colors marking the grass where builds are targeted. The goal is to avoid impact, but public records show that's not always happening in Google's case. The bulk of the notices of violation issued by the city were for builds that impacted marked lines, records show. But Gerard says it can be more complicated, as crews are working with bulky equipment and lines aren't always where the paint says they'll be. He calls line impacts project killers that take up time and cost money. "No one wants that," he says, adding that crews typically dig holes by hand to try to get a visual on a utility line before using a bore machine, a massive device that pushes rods into the ground. Via a beacon, a crew member, typically there are about three on site at each dig, can control the drill angle. A conduit, those orange tubes winding around giant reels, is attached, and as the rods are pulled back up, the orange tubes will await the actual fiber cable. It's a time-intensive project, Gerard says. A 1,000-foot project might take a team a week, and accidents happen, whether you're Google Fiber, AT&T, or Time Warner Cable, he says. Email records show cities have been inundated with project management tasks, with Raleigh even going so far as to schedule weekly meetings with contractors and department officials to discuss Google Fiber implementation. Noah Otto, Raleigh's right-of-way coordinator, says issues are the direct result of the sheer volume of the permits involved in a project this massive. Even given these challenges, resolutions to citizen concerns have been mostly positive, he writes in an email. Yards ripped up. Yadkin Drive resident Mary Lewis James says litter from probably about 300 pounds of cable to rocks disrupted her yard when contractors pushed through. And she says, both in an interview and in complaints registered with city officials, that contractors tried to cover up the pockmarks they left behind, covering rocks with a thin layer of topsoil. What if my lawnmower had hit that? She says. Not far away on Northbrook Drive, Sanders says trenching equipment wrecked his underground irrigation system. Emails he sent to the city show he claims $6,000 in damages. It was like they got a hold of the daggone pipe and shook it, he says, of contractor activity, adding that he's still going back and forth with officials for reimbursement. Many complaints, Sanders included, failed to result in an official notification violation by the city, but incidents that do warrant notices are on the rise. October alone saw 7 notifications in Raleigh, nearly a third of the total issued to Google Fiber contractors for calendar 2016. And many come with bizarre allegations, such as a notice in February, where a resident on Wingate Drive claimed in city documents that a contractor had arrived around midnight to try to cover up a sewage line leak. That contractor, working without the city's permission, also violated rules that state work can't be done after 8:30 p.m. in residential neighborhoods in Raleigh, according to the violation, resulting in fines and damages worth more than $3,400. Emails show communication has been an issue at times in levying the fines. The city of Raleigh issued a notice of violation and a bill for more than $14,000 in fines and damages to contractors in July for a May incident on Myron Drive. Email records show the issue wasn't resolved until October, despite multiple pleas from the city. In that incident, according to the notice, contractors bored through a sewer line, despite manhole evidence of infrastructure beneath the ground, and went outside of the right-of-way into private property. The incidents aren't limited to Raleigh. While Morrisville doesn't own its utilities and doesn't levy fines for breaks in water mains and sewage lines, city spokeswoman Erin Hudson says similar incidents have been reported within town limits. And in Durham, officials have sent out 16 notices of violation and 16 notices of penalty for water quality issues. Durham has also issued 6 stop work orders, 2 for failing to notify residents of work being done, which is among the most consistent allegations made by residents in Raleigh. Kay Moore, who complained to the city of Raleigh after contractors left debris at her Lassiter Mill Road property, says she was never notified Google Fiber would be working in her neighborhood. We were aware they were around Raleigh, but we had no prior notification they'd be digging that day, she says. Sanders echoed those statements. I'm an old man. The city never told us they were doing this, he says. They never sent us a letter. And that's something that concerns Raleigh's Otto. He notes that the city requires permitted contractors to notify property owners in advance of construction. We consider this communication to be most critical to the success of any project, he says, adding that communication in itself can go a long way toward mitigating damages. If there has been a failure by the permittee to notify property owners in advance, we ask that they report it to the city. But residents and even homeowners associations requesting specifics about Google Fiber's plans with contractors weren't given details about the geography involved in the build-out. We cannot give out information if it has not been released by Google, Gregory Zimmerman, a lead field engineer at Bechtel, told city officials when forwarding a message from the Briar Creek Homeowners Association. Good neighbors. While Google wouldn't be specific about the process, Eric Garr, site lead for the firm's Triangle build-out, says in a statement, "Google Fiber is undertaking one of the biggest and most complex infrastructure projects in Triangle history. We want to be good neighbors, so we're doing everything we can to prevent unnecessary disruptions and resolve issues quickly." Google says it works with utilities to identify sites of underground infrastructure and has a team that speaks with customers with concerns. The company wouldn't be specific about its resolution methods or processes. Officials at individual municipalities say they're monitoring the build-out. Ken Dunn, Engineering Development Review Supervisor for the town of Cary, says once a contractor has completed permitted work, his team will walk the work area and note any deficiencies. "We then work with the applicant to repair noted deficiencies," he says, adding that the town requires issuance of a bond as part of its right-of-way encroachment application process, and if repairs are not satisfactory, the town will cash in the bond as funding and complete the work that way. But monitoring construction appears to be frustrating for some officials. Chester Lepley with the City of Raleigh Right-of-Way Inspections Department is among those expressing frustrations through emails with colleagues. Citing asphalt issues, he says, have gone months without being addressed. He wrote October 4, "This is unacceptable, and if we need to stop permitting and or allowing encroachments, then maybe we need to consider that. Do we, Raleigh, need to just start shutting crews down to get repairs attended to in a timely manner?" Errant damage to town and residential property is just one of the issues. Records also suggest contractors have violated traffic regulations in their permits in at least Raleigh and Durham. An October 13 email from George Medeiros, market construction manager at Bechtel, refers to a violation of a North Carolina Department of Transportation permit on Six Forks Road in Raleigh. But in the email, Medeiros said the incident was being taken seriously. Although there were not injuries or physical damages to infrastructure as a result of what happened yesterday, we did impact the community, he wrote, referencing part of the permit provision limiting lane closures from happening between 6 and 9 a.m. and 4 to 7 p.m. during weekdays and inclement weather. Medeiros referred all questions to Google Fiber. In Durham, at least two work stops have been ordered for traffic control issues, according to the city. North Carolina DOT spokesman Steve Abbott had no direct knowledge of fiber incidents, but said work hour limits were a standard safety measure when it comes to construction conducted in roadways. Confident about the future. Most economic development officials say this year's frustrations will be worth it. When Google announced it plans to bring fiber to the area in January 2015, CEOs and officials celebrated. Channel Advisor Chairman Scott Wingo called it a rising tide for all Internet applications. NetCertive CEO Brendan Morrissey called the move an outstanding statement about what the Triangle represents, a tech-savvy, fast-growing, thriving entrepreneurial ecosystem. They said it's not just about the high-speed service, and data appears to back up that optimism. A Wichita State University study showed that a year after Google Fiber came to Kansas City, home values rose by nearly 3%. Already, Google Fiber's announcement has been followed by a slew of other players entering the Triangle. Many, such as AT&T and Frontier Communications, have already debuted residential fiber services. AT&T North Carolina President Vanessa Harrison says market competition is absolutely a motivator. It's good for the whole area, she says. Levin, who says fiber is coming to the Triangle, like it or not, offers some comfort to disrupted residents. As Google moves forward, they learn and they improve and they course correct, he says. It's not surprising to me early on that errors like that are made. But due to the invasiveness of the process itself, it's not just newer entrants making mistakes. Levin says these kinds of construction complexities are one reason some cities are trying to put in their own conduit so they can get benefits of fiber and competition without having to dig up streets every couple of years. Levin expects North Carolina to have the most competitive fiber market in the country next year and says that when it's all weighed out, it will be fantastic for the Triangle. It just has to get through the growing pains, which, as Google Fiber has only debuted in Morrisville so far, could just be beginning. And along with this article, there's a little box of information captioned, "Where is fiber?" Currently, Raleigh, Charlotte, Atlanta, Nashville, Tennessee, Kansas City, Austin, Texas, Provo, Utah, Salt Lake City. Upcoming, Huntsville, Alabama, San Antonio, Orange County, California, San Francisco. Potential, Jacksonville, Florida, Tampa, Louisville, Kentucky, Chicago, Oklahoma City, Dallas, Phoenix, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Jose, and Portland, Oregon. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The main headline, businesses helping PacStar fight ALS. Businesses across Raleigh have rallied around a former NC State University baseball player who is battling ALS. Chris Combs, 41, now works for the Wolfpack Club and was a star baseball player for the school. His father, Francis, played baseball at State and is on the Wolfpack football broadcast. One of Francis Combs' closest friends growing up in Perkiomen County was Jimmy Catfish Hunter, a star pitcher in the majors who died from ALS. Chris Combs, married with three children, discovered something was wrong when he noticed an odd twitching of his muscles in March. Months later, the diagnosis of ALS was confirmed. He is doing all he can to raise awareness of the illness. A September gala to raise money for Project ALS brought in more than $1 million. Many other businesses joined in to help, including H Street Kitchen. "The amount of support we've received has been overwhelming," Chris Combs says. Combs was even pumping gas at the Exxon station at Glenwood Village when station owner Brian Barker came to speak to him. "He's a big, healthy guy with three children," Barker says. "I first saw him at the gas pump one day and introduced myself. Then I just felt compelled to do something." In December, Barker and his father, Mike, are donating 2 cents from every gallon sold at the two Exxon stores they own at Glenwood Village and North Hills. Barker says the North Hills store regularly pumps out 140,000 gallons per month and the Glenwood store 85,000. "I'd love to write a check for $6,000 at the end of the month," Barker says. Combs and his family have been touched by those remarkable shows of support. "For me, dealing with the disease of ALS with no cure now, you want to do anything you can," he says. McCrory irked as sale of Raleigh land tabled. For what was supposed to be a relatively uneventful last Council of State meeting for Governor Pat McCrory, State Treasurer Janet Cowell, State Superintendent June Atkinson, and Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin, the fireworks started early December 6. Project Phoenix Director John LaPenta was caught off guard when, after discussing a purchase offer for a former state prison in Charlotte and no questions were asked, Commissioner of Agriculture Steve Troxler motioned to table a vote on the sale. "I don't think this has been fully vetted," Troxler said. That annoyed McCrory, who said, "What procedures have not been followed? This is a dilapidated eyesore. We just wait and wait and wait in state government and never move." The council voted to approve the prison sale, but the stage was set for opposition to the sale of the 75,000-square-foot personnel training property on West P Street and three boarded-up buildings on Caswell Square in downtown Raleigh. The council voted to delay a vote on both property sale proposals until more details could be presented. Military wife gets shoe deal. A Pinehurst mother and military wife is a part of a national campaign by Rackroom Shoes of Charlotte to feature real people and not actors in commercials. Anita Craig has been married 10 years and moved 13 times with her husband in the military. "Hey, all that running around will create a real need for shoes, right?" North Carolina at risk of losing NCAA events for years. A looming NCAA deadline could impact whether North Carolina hosts any NCAA championship events through 2022. On April 18, the NCAA will announce championship sites for 4 years, beginning with the 2018 to 2019 academic year. If House Bill 2 remains law, North Carolina might face a major snub. "We're looking at a potential 6-year window or drought," says Scott Dupree, executive director of the Greater Raleigh Sports Alliance. and we are on a very tight timeline to get it resolved. In September, the NCAA yanked its championship events scheduled for neutral events in North Carolina for this academic year. The NCAA did not act on events scheduled for next year, but made it clear those are in jeopardy. Now, the NCAA is about to begin a new four-year process that will set all championship events, including basketball tournament games, through 2022. NC State University is bidding on early round and regional games for 2019, 2020, 2021, and 2022. Home prices in Triangle soar since 2006. Triangle homeowners rejoice. Homes in the Raleigh-Cary market soared 19.5% from the third quarter of 2006 to the third quarter of 2016. That ranks that MSA 18th in the nation, according to research by American City Business Journals. Right behind in the rankings was Durham-Chapel Hill, with a 10-year growth of 18.8%. Charlotte was 24th at 16.6%. Austin, Texas was the national leader, with homes rising a whopping 64.9% over 10 years. But if you'd bet on property in Las Vegas, Nevada, you were out of luck. There, home prices dipped 31.8%, the biggest drop in the nation. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline: Grub Ventures backs off $500 million Glenwood Place development. Apartments retail still on. Nearly 2 years after two North Carolina real estate firms announced ambitious joint plans to transform the outdated Glenwood Place office park on Glenwood Avenue into an upscale mixed-use extension of Raleigh's Midtown, it's back to the drawing board. Grub Ventures CEO Gordon Grub confirmed his team has backed off its request for a new master plan approval from the city for the entire 40-acre business park that he and his investors have owned since 1999. The framework for the nearly $500 million Glenwood Place project had proposed the demolition of eight small office buildings in the park and replacing them with a mix of hotel, office, retail, and multifamily buildings. The firm is still moving forward with a new apartment and retail complex that's now under construction, but it's reconsidering plans for the rest of the park. "We took a break on the rezoning and now we're dusting it back off," Grubb says. "It was taking longer than we had thought it would." Charlotte-based Lincoln Harris is no longer a partner in the project, but Grubb didn't rule out the possibility of another future venture with the firm. "We parted very amicably, and we've left the door open," he says. In the meantime, Grubb has cleared nearly 13 acres of trees along Women's Club Drive and started vertical construction for the nearly $40 million Sojourn Glenwood Place apartment complex. The project, which will have close to 10,000 square feet of retail space, is expected to open to tenants in fall 2017. A coffee shop will open in the first quarter inside the 3700 Glenwood office building. Israeli investors buys Raleigh's Wakefield Commons for $21.75 million. A North American affiliate of Israel-based Mishorim Development Group has acquired the Wakefield Commons Shopping Center in North Raleigh for $21.75 million, according to county records. The investor, Mishorim Gold NC LP of Windermere, Florida, purchased the center from Dallas-based Westdale Real Estate Investment. Westdale bought the property in 2011 for $24.7 million. About a week before its anchor tenant at the time, a Kroger grocery store, announced it was closing. Westdale later settled a lawsuit against the seller, claiming deception in the financial stability of the property. Galaxy Fun Park now occupies the old Kroger space. Lidl to hold first U.S. hiring event on December 12. Lidl U.S., the U.S. subsidiary of the low-cost German grocery chain that's planning to begin opening its first stores on the East Coast next year, will be holding its first public hiring event for store management at the Greenville Convention Center on December 12. As of December 6th, the company had listed descriptions for 23 job openings in North Carolina, including store management and supervisor positions and warehouse positions at its new distribution center, opening soon in Alamance County. The initial annual salary for the store management positions will be up to $60,000, depending on the location. Durham's Gugglehupf to expand to Chapel Hill. The Gugglehupf Bakery, Cafe, and Restaurant in Durham has announced plans to expand and open a new bake shop in Chapel Hill by April. Gugglehupf will be opening the 1,250-square-foot shop at the Eastgate Crossing Shopping Center and will sell many of the same German and European-style breads, pastries, desserts, and baked goods made at the Durham location that has been open and expanding since 1998. North Hills to add new restaurant, new boutiques in the spring. The management team at North Hills in Raleigh has announced that Aladdin's Eatery will be opening a new restaurant in the spring in the former Black Cat Cafe space in the Lassiter District. Also coming soon to North Hills in early 2017 will be new clothing boutique stores for Copper Penny, Lilly Pulitzer, and Marta's, plus a second location in Raleigh for Paint Bar Nail Salon and a Kilwin's Chocolate and Ice Cream Shop. And finally, there's one last section in memoriam. The quote, "People all shared similar stories of Ken being gracious, kind, steady, and always generous with his time with anyone who sought out his advice, guidance, and mentorship. Several people, myself included, credit him with helping them get to where they are today. I learned so much from him, not only about economic development, but about leadership and how to stay focused on what's really important." And that was from Adrienne Cole, Executive Director of Wake County Economic Development, upon news that her predecessor, longtime Director Ken Atkins, had died December 1 following a brief illness. And now we turn to the OnTech transportation page written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, Delta's ramp up at RDU includes Swankier Club. Club features art of North Carolina landmarks. A months-long renovation at Delta Airlines' RDU Sky Club is officially complete, and it's just the latest investment the carrier has made at Raleigh-Durham International Airport in 2016. Victoria Forbes Roberts, Vice President of Pricing and Revenue Management for the Atlanta-based airline, says its bullseye on RDU is already starting to pay off. Delta's direct-to-Paris flight out of RDU, which debuted in May, is doing better than expected, she says. Other 2016 additions for Delta at RDU have included flights to Washington, Newark, New Jersey, and Salt Lake City. And as flight numbers increase, so do passenger counts, which is why the company has revamped and expanded its Delta Sky Club. Forbes Roberts won't say whether another flight addition is in the works. "I think the investments we have made have worked for us," she says. "We're really happy with the growth and the pace we're growing here, so we'll see." The move doubles the seating capacity and, quote, "really opens the space up," says Mark Kozak, Regional Operations Manager for Atlanta Raleigh Santiago Sky Clubs at Delta. "It's much lighter to me. It's much more inviting to the guest." The Sky Club sees between 400 and 500 guests on a typical day, a count expected to increase as Delta grows its presence in RDU, hence the upgrade. And Kozak, a Chicago native, finds the artwork particularly intriguing. Paintings by North Carolina artist Jeff Cohen depicting iconic North Carolina brands from Krispy Kreme to Mount Olive Pickles to Cheerwine, which Kozak had never heard of before, the RDU Delta Sky Club line one wall. Photographs of university landmarks and North Carolina landscapes line another. He says Delta has a curator managing its art program and working with local artists and finding the humanity within each city. While he won't say what Delta has invested in its revamp, only that it's somewhere between hundreds of thousands and multiple millions of dollars, he does say the investment means the airline is certainly committed to RDU, a statement Forbes Roberts echoes. "Our investment in Raleigh-Durham is part of our strategy to be the preferred global carrier here in Raleigh-Durham," she says, "and that comes in the form of infusions into both facilities and flights, such as the recently added direct-to-Austin route, which debuts in March." Layoffs were light in Triangle in November, North Carolina report says. The Triangle region was relatively unscathed by pink slips in November. Out of the 224 total layoffs reported to the state during the month, the only impact in eastern North Carolina was at Wilson's Voith Paper Fabrics that affected 64 workers. That's according to the North Carolina Department of Commerce. By December 1, it had reported a total of 72 notices impacting 11,538 positions in the 2016 calendar year. Commerce collects the data through a state filing called WARN, Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification, which is required when a company closes a plant, cuts 500 jobs, or eliminates one-third of its local positions. The bulk of the reported cuts for the month of November came out of Caba Ilco Corporation, which reported 123 cuts in Winston-Salem. Morganton's Northwest Furniture Express reported 37 layoff notifications in the month. And now in a section called She Said It, the quote, I have spent every day around people who are optimistic, who really think they can be the next big thing, and I'll be bringing that attitude in. That quote is from Joan Seaford Rose, resigning CED CEO, discussing her new job, a senior partner position at Creo, which she starts in January. And also there's He Said It, the quote, Johnston County has a line that runs east to west, but along the I-95 corridor. It's been woefully underserved by natural gas. So having this line run parallel along the corridor will help recruit manufacturing. And that's from Chris Johnson, Economic Development Director for Johnston County, on the proposed Atlantic Coast Pop Line. And finally, in the one section called New Position, Bob Giolis, former CEO of Research Triangle Foundation, the managing organization for Research Triangle Park, has been tapped to lead the new Raleigh office of a national consulting firm. Giolis joins HR&A Advisors, a real estate and economic development consulting firm, with other offices in New York, Dallas, Los Angeles, and Washington. And now we turn to the On Life Sciences page, written by Jennifer Henderson. The main headline, Regional Growth Propelling UNC Rec's Revenue Toward $1 Billion. Revenue at UNC Rex Healthcare has been on the rise and is slated to cross the $1 billion mark this fiscal year, according to hospital executives. Oncology and surgery are the most profitable lines, followed closely by heart and vascular, Steve Burris, president of UNC Rex, tells Triangle Business Journal. Operating revenue for the fiscal year that ended June 30 was $954.09 million, up roughly 12%. From $853.34 million the year prior, confirmed UNC Rec spokesman Alan Wolf, the hospital expects revenue to pass $1 billion this fiscal year. Revenue has more than doubled over the last decade. It was $395 million for the 2006 fiscal year, Wolf says. UNC Rec continues to treat more people from outside Raleigh, says Burris. That includes increasing referrals from other hospitals affiliated with UNC Healthcare, such as Johnston Health, Wayne Memorial, Nash Health, and Lenore Memorial, Wolf says. Along with increased volume, the hospital is also seeing increased patient acuity levels, executives say. But with higher acuity, efficiency is even more important in terms of managing costs, says Burris. Aside from revenue, UNC Rex has continued to grow its headcount. The hospital recently passed 6,000 employees, and additional hiring is expected for the hospital's new Heart and Vascular Center, opening in spring. Burris says the new center is the first step in replacing some of the hospital's older infrastructure. But it's going to be a hospital going, but it's not going to be a hospital bed building frenzy for UNC Rex. Burris notes the importance of primary care in lowering healthcare costs, catching problems before they become chronic conditions. NeuroCog Trials Expanding in Durham. Durham-based NeuroCog Trials, which provides cognition services for the clinical trials industry, is expanding its headcount and office space after branching into linguistics and software. The 12-year-old company is expanding into a second floor at the South Court office complex in Durham to occupy 22,500 square feet at the building. It currently employs 105 full-time employees and is looking to add more. A lot of our trials were becoming global, so we would have to get translators to do interpretations of the new ratings, or if we had our own instruments, to put them into languages used in other trials, says Richard Keefe, CEO and co-founder of NeuroCog Trials. Through its new language services division, NCT Linguistics, which officially launched earlier this year, the company also offers translation services outside of clinical trials in such areas as contracts and tax documentation, he says. The full-time in-house linguistics department currently consists of 5 employees and works with 1,500 contractors in 150 languages, Keefe says. As for software development, NeuroCog Trials is growing both its iPad-based BAC app, Brief Assessment of Cognition app, and its VRFCAT, Virtual Reality Functional Capacity Assessment Tool. Earlier this year, the company announced it received a $1.4 million grant from the National Institute on Aging for the BAC app and a $2 million grant from the National Institute of Mental Health for VRFCAT. The company's software team currently has 15 full-time employees and is hiring, Keefe says. More money for RTP's Metabolon. Research Triangle Park-based Metabolon Incorporated has raised an additional $15 million from healthcare-focused growth equity firm Essex Woodlands. Essex Woodlands previously invested $15 million in Metabolon in August. The $30 million investment was structured in two parts, according to John Riles, president and CEO of Metabolon. Essex Woodlands bought out several existing shareholders through its latest investment, which will be used for the development of new product areas, says Riles. We've been talking with Essex for 5 or 6 years now. Metabolon finally got to the point of growth where we're in their sweet spot, Riles says. New product areas for Metabolon currently include tests focused on obesity and chronic kidney disease. The company has developed a pipeline of precision medicine products using a proprietary metabolomics technology. Metabolon grew to about 170 people this year, up from 150 in 2015, says Riles. Most are in the Research Triangle Park. Metabolon has raised about $95 million since it began in 2000. Roy Vant could double Durham headcount by 2017, and that's spelled R-O-I-V-A-N-T. Roivant Sciences Limited, the Bermuda-based biopharmaceutical company behind Axovant and Myovant, is beefing up its Durham presence, increasing headcount and office space. Founded in 2014 by Vivek Ramaswamy, Revant scoops up what the company calls shelved product candidates with potential in order to move those drugs through the clinical development process. Roivant doesn't discriminate when it comes to therapeutic areas, says Bill Simons, chief development officer of Roivant. We look for good compounds and diseases with unmet medical needs, he says. Some of the candidates are developed under the Roivant banner and others are spun off into separate companies. For instance, Roivant spun off Axovant and Myovant, which both went public in sizable initial public offerings in 2015 and 2016, respectively. Axovant is focused on a Phase 3 program for an Alzheimer's drug that was acquired from GlaxoSmithKline, while Myovant is collaborating with Takeda on women's health. While Riovant's bases include such spots outside the triangle as New York, California, and Switzerland, its research and development-heavy outpost in Durham is growing fast. Simon says it currently employs about 25 people and has been adding 3 to 4 new hires each week. He says he expects the headcount in Durham to reach between 40 and 50 people by mid-2017. To meet the demands, Roivant will move into a larger office space in February, he says. The company currently occupies about 2,500 square feet at the Venable Center and will increase that to about 9,000 square feet at its new home at the American Tobacco Campus, Simon says. Bioventus optimistic, but no IPO planned. Durham-based Bioventus, which put its planned $150 million initial public offering on hold earlier this year, announced recently that it found patient compliance improved 10% for its latest generation Exogen Ultrasound Bone Healing System. Exogen represents more than $100 million in annual global revenue for the company, says the Bioventus spokesman. Of its planned IPO, the spokesman says Bioventus opted to raise funds to fuel the growth of business through other channels and that there will be no resumption of the IPO in the immediate future. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the A Better World page written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. First, we'll read his column, the headline on the column, Hundreds of Children Fly Free to Get Care. In the last 10 years, children who were seriously ill or injured but faced hurdles getting to medical facilities have received 1,500 free flights, thanks to Children's Flight of Hope, a nonprofit in Morrisville. Travel to treatment is often an overlooked component of getting children the care they need, says Stacy Barfield, the group's executive director. Insurance doesn't pay for the travel or lodging of any of these children. If we didn't provide these flights, they'd forego or postpone treatment until they had the money. Formed in 1991 by Al Wethington, a Durham pilot and businessman, Children's Flight of Hope operates with a staff of 4 people and an annual budget of $821,000. It also gets in-kind support valued at about $500,000, mainly in the form of flights that companies and American Airlines donate. It also counts on 150 active volunteers who mainly work on 3 annual events that net a total of about $360,000. The group gets the rest of its funds from individuals and corporations, plus some grant support. It pays for most of its flights. This year, through October, it spent $145,000 on commercial flights and $84,000 on private flights. Through November 11, it had provided 408 flights for 127 families and expects to have provided 500 flights by the end of the year. Until this past spring, flights had been limited to children living or needing to get to medical facilities east of the Mississippi River. The biggest share of the children and destinations are in North Carolina. Thanks to a 1-year partnership it formed in April with American Airlines, American is letting the nonprofit use for its own clients 2 million miles of flights donated to the airline. In return, Children's Flight of Hope will handle 8 million miles of charity flights American routes to Children's Flight of Hope. The nonprofit developed that partnership in the wake of $151,000 in seed money it received in 2015 from the CAP Community Foundation, the charitable arm of CAP Trust Financial Advisors in Raleigh. Now, Children's Flight of Hope is considering the creation of hubs in 10 other markets, plus the Triad in Charlotte, Barfield says. Developing the hubs will depend on interest from local volunteers, funders, and companies. With a $15,000 grant from Wilmington's Eshelman Foundation, she says it is also considering expanding there. Since 2014, Children's Flight of Hope also has raised about $400,000 through a campaign known as Join Our Crew that focuses on recurring donors that give an annual gift for a number of years. 3 donors each have made pledges to give $20,000 a year for 5 years. The nonprofit mainly flies children to pediatric specialty centers for a broad range of illnesses, including orphan diseases that are rare and for which research and treatment is not supported by institutional programs or organizations. The treatments we're sending them to, Barfield says, are going to save, prolong, or dramatically improve the quality of their lives. And now in nonprofit news, Healing Transition starts donor effort. A Raleigh facility with a long history of effectively battling addiction has launched a new program to allow people to donate on a monthly basis. The Men's Facility for Healing Transitions, formerly known as the Healing Place, is located at 1251 Good Street in South Raleigh near the State Farmers Market. The Women's Center is located at 3304 Glen Royal Road. Anyone with substance abuse problems can get food, board, and counseling for free. The program is demanding, but gets addicts on the road to recovery. The cost of housing is about $40 per day per person. Healing Transitions, which has an annual operating budget of $3.6 million, has launched its ChangeMaker program, where donors can give $40 a month to provide one day of service. The center holds its men's transition ceremony December 15 to celebrate people who recently completed the program. Middle school awards honor Raleigh Banker. 10 North Carolina middle school students have been awarded Victor E. Bell Jr. scholarships given to 7th grade students with high potential to help them aspire to go to college. Winners get $2,000 per year through their fourth year at a North Carolina college. The scholarships are named in honor of Bell, a longtime Raleigh banker who chaired the College Foundation Incorporated's Board of Trustees for 30 years. This year's recipients, Eric Michael Banks Garner, Angela Waramalreya Charlotte, Charlotte Elizabeth Lanigan, Swanoa, Nathan Riley Nelson, Ruffin, Jalen Platt, Greenville, Chastity Robinson, Warsaw, Raven McKenzie Towns, Kinston, Brooklyn R. Turpin, Robbinsville, Leanna Aldacaris, Umanzor, Mint Hill, and Yuritsa Ventura, Spring Hope. Help for families at UNC Children's Hospital. UNC Children's Hospital has partnered with a new local business for a holiday donation to patients and patients' families. Courtney's Drop-In Kids Care, an on-demand child care center that opened in Chapel Hill on December 1, will donate a portion of December proceeds to the hospital. Courtney's also will offer free child care to siblings of children being treated at UNC Children's Hospital throughout December. And now we're going to go to the Viewpoint page, and we'll read the Viewpoint column of Mark Murrow, who is a senior fellow and policy director for the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. And the headline on his column is, "Manufacturing is already growing, but jobs?" Pundits will debate the wellsprings of Donald Trump's election triumph for years. Right now, cultural explanations are in the lead. Multiple researchers and journalists are stressing the role of racial resentments and xenophobia as the deepest sources of Trump's appeal, and such explanations cannot be dismissed. But the decades-long decline of U.S. manufacturing employment and the highly automated nature of the sector's recent revitalization should also be high on the list of explanations. The former is an unmistakable source of the working-class rage that helped get Trump elected. The latter is the main reason Trump won't be able to make America great again by bringing back production jobs. The Rust Belt epicenter of the Trump electoral map says a lot about its emotional origins, but so do the facts of employment and productivity in U.S. manufacturing industries. The collapse of labor-intensive commodity manufacturing in recent decades and the expansion in this decade of super-productive advanced manufacturing have left millions of working-class white people feeling abandoned, irrelevant, and angry. To see this, one has only to look at the stark trend lines of the production data, which show a massive 30-year decline of employment beginning in 1980. That trend led to the liquidation of more than a third of U.S. manufacturing positions. Employment in the sector plunged from 18.9 million jobs to 12.2 million. Much of the dislocation was concentrated in Midwestern and other Rust Belt states, where entire communities were devastated by the loss of production work. This clearly visited widespread dislocation on blue-collar workers in manufacturing-oriented metropolitan areas. Since 2000 alone, millions of workers have lost manufacturing jobs paying $25 per hour, plus health and retirement benefits. Often the only alternatives were service sector jobs without benefits paying $12 an hour. One result has been a sharp increase in political polarization in affected congressional districts, as MIT economist David Autor and his co-authors demonstrated this fall in a study of locations exposed to low-cost Chinese imports. In those communities, the loss of manufacturing jobs led to political polarization that last month led to the election of Trump. Manufacturing employment has, in fact, ticked up since 2010, reflecting the post-crisis auto boom and the relative strength of the nation's advanced manufacturing industries. But that hasn't mollified angry displaced workers. While it's encouraging for American competitiveness and some local clusters, the new growth has been far too little, far too late to ease the distress that surely contributed to Trump's turnout in many manufacturing communities. It bears noting that the nature of the new manufacturing growth may only be deepening the political problem of manufacturing. Trump promises to bring back millions of manufacturing jobs for dispossessed workers by modifying the terms of trade, by renegotiating NAFTA, rejecting the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and slapping China with tariffs. But the fact is that the U.S. manufacturing sector has been succeeded by many measures in recent years. The U.S. manufacturing sector has been succeeding by many measures in recent years. In fact, the total inflation-adjusted output of the U.S. manufacturing sector is now higher than it has ever been. That's true even as the sector's employment is growing only slowly and remains near the lowest it's been. These diverging lines, which reflect the sector's improved productivity, highlight a huge problem with Trump's promises to help workers by reshoring millions of manufacturing jobs. America is already producing a lot. And in any event, the return of more manufacturing won't bring back many jobs because the labor is increasingly being done by robots. Boston Consulting Group reports that it costs barely $8 per hour to use a robot for spot welding in the auto industry, compared to $25 for a worker. And the gap is only going to widen. It's going to take an unprecedented spirit of realism about technology, about trade, about inevitable change to address those frustrations. And in our final minutes, we'll look at some news from around the state in the Triangle Business Journal. First headline, Bank of America raising minimum wage to $15. And this article is written by Hillary Burns. Bank of America Corporation will raise wages for hourly non-commissioned employees in early 2017 to a minimum $15 per hour, up from a minimum $13.50 per hour today. Brian Moynihan, CEO and chairman of the Charlotte-based bank, mentioned the wage increase during a presentation at the Goldman Sachs Financial Services Conference December 6. Brian Moynihan, CEO and chairman of Bank of America, spoke at an industry conference this week. Ferris Morrison, a bank spokeswoman, says most hourly non-commissioned roles at the bank fall in the consumer business and the global operations and technology business. The upcoming wage increases were announced internally earlier this year. This is something we've looked at over time, Morrison says. It's something we look at on a regular basis and have been doing so for a number of years. Bank of America announced other employee benefits earlier this year when the company extended maternity and paternity leave to 16 weeks from 12 weeks for its U.S. employees. Bank of America employs about 15,000 people at its Charlotte headquarters. Moynihan also said he is not surprised people have taken a much more optimistic view on the banking industry as well as on Bank of America following Donald Trump's election win. Bank of America shares opened at $22.08 on December 6, up from about $17 in early November. Moynihan says the bank's recent strong earnings on top of expected interest rate hikes bodes well for Bank of America. Popular Western North Carolina store considers Triad. Could Mass General Store or one of VF Corporation's many brands soon anchor a downtown Greensboro redevelopment? Developer Andy Zimmerman hopes so. Zimmerman confirmed he has talked to representatives of Mass General Store and VF Corporation about the property at 620 South Elm Street. Mass General has popular stores located in downtown Boone and Hendersonville. More specifically, he's approached them about operating a retail store in the original of the two Bluebell buildings, the one that fronts South Elm. Zimmerman said the second building, which stretches along Bain Street, forming an L-shaped complex, probably would be an office building. The 1.6-acre complex, last known as Old Greensboro Gateway Center, also borders Gate City Boulevard. I had a meeting with VF, and I have been talking to Mass General Store, said Zimmerman, whose developments along the south end of downtown Greensboro include his home base, HQ Greensboro. I've had great conversations with Mass General Store. If they say they are interested, they've done their homework. They've had great success in Winston-Salem. Zimmerman said he hopes to get a demolition permit for the interior and start the demolition process by the end of this week. Taiwanese company adding textile operation in North Carolina. A Taiwanese company will spend $18.5 million to bring a sports fabric weaving and finishing operation that will employ 610 to Forest City. Everest Textiles USA, a unit of Everest Textile Company Limited in Tainan City, Taiwan, expects to start production of the fabric during the second or third quarter next year, says Tom Johnson, interim director of the Rutherford County Economic Development Commission. We are very pleased to see the return of this type of industry to the county, Johnson says. North Carolina Representative David Rogers says the textiles' return to Rutherford County shows Western North Carolina is competitive with any region in the world when it comes to manufacturing. Everest Textiles will take over an existing building that measures almost 400,000 square feet. Workers will weave, dye, and finish the fabric for sports apparel. It's the company's first U.S. operation. The company now supplies apparel to companies such as Nike, Columbia, and Patagonia from Asian factories. And finally, on the People on the Move page, the spotlight is on Pat O'Keefe, Raleigh office director at Clark Nexen. In October of this year, Virginia Beach, Virginia-based architecture, engineering, and design firm Clark Nexen announced several executive leadership changes that directly impacted the two top leaders of the firm's Raleigh office. Clymer Cease would be named the firm's new chairman and Terry Hall its new president. The firm would now need a new Raleigh office leader. Enter Pat O'Keefe, a principal of the firm and its former science and technology market leader. He is now charged with outlining its strategic vision and growth, providing the day-to-day management of the local office as well as leading projects. And we're going to have to stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.